All right, today isn't too terribly painfully long. We're doing two major things, as you should already know. One of which is testing for the presence or absence of various chemicals, which is the most of the time spent. But also, don't forget, you're doing some pH testing using pH strips. And you could start with that if you want. I don't care. It only takes a few minutes, but if there's a huge group of people all waiting over here, don't do that. There's two identical brown trays of pH strips, so use either one. I won't say anything more about pH strips because I think you already know how to use them or can figure it out. If you're not, just ask me. And that's also true for the main part, which is the chemical testing you're doing. It's really an exercise in following instructions. So this is the importance of working together and talking it out as you do this. It's pretty straightforward, though, for two of the tests. Actually, it's straightforward conducting them for all three, but I'm going to talk about one of them in particular today for a couple reasons I'll say in a second. Let's first, though, list the three. What are the three tests?
IKI.
And by the way, IKI is a chemical formula. That stands for iodine, potassium iodide. Benedict's test. And what's the other one? The Biurette test. It looks like it should be a French word, but it's Biurette. Anyway, each of these tests for different things. What is the IKI test for? I'll accept that second answer. It tests for starch, which is a polysaccharide, but it doesn't test for general carbohydrates. For instance, monosaccharides will give it a negative result. It tests specifically for starch. And that one is really easy to use because the positive is so drastic. It turns almost black if it's really positive. But anyway, that's what that tests for. Starch specifically. Now, actually, before I go on, let me just say, in general, tests like this are useful because it's often the case where you have a solution of something, but you don't know what's in it. And tests like this, which are visual indicator tests, they change somehow visually to you. You can see visually that they have worked or haven't worked. Those are useful for two major reasons. Whether it's positive or negative, the result of the test tells you whether that specific stuff is there. In other words, it gives you a yes or no answer. Yes, there is for the case of IKA starch there, or no, there isn't. But also in the case of yes, a lot of these visual tests also give you a qualitative, not quantitative, not a number, but a qualitative result of relatively how much of that stuff is there, depending on how positive the test is. In other words, you can compare two positive tests and you can say that this one had more of that stuff than the other one that had some. Okay, that's a qualitative test, not a quantitative test, which you're actually measuring something with numbers. But IKI, test for starch. What about the Biurette test? Yes, it tests for the presence of proteins. And how do you know that they are present? What's it look like? It changes to a violet color, yes. Those are straightforward ones. And that's all I'm going to say about them. Just follow the instructions for that. The other one, though, is the Benedict's test, which tests for the presence of monosaccharides. And not a specific monosaccharide. Any given monosaccharide will work for Benedict's test. It will give you a positive result. The reason I want to talk about this one is not because it's harder to conduct the test. It's the same as the others, really. I want to talk about it not only so you understand things for today and for the quiz, but also because what I'm about to talk about will be something we'll talk much more about in what most people's hardest unit is, Unit 3, coming up in lecture. Okay? We're in Unit 2 now, but after the second test is when we'll be talking about redox reactions in greater detail, which is main focus of my sermon today. Now, the word redox is a portmanteau, which is a word formed by combining two other words, like spork, for instance. Redox, though, is short for reduction and oxidation, or reduction / oxidation. And I like the fact that they formed one word on this, not just because it's easier than saying reduction oxidation, but because by using one word, it reminds you of the important fact that if either of these two things happens, then they both happen. You can't have just reduction or just oxidation. You have either neither or both. Now, I need to get through some terminology that seems confusing at first to a lot of people. But since we're going to be talking a lot about this in lecture, I want you to have these definitions down. So the first one is reduction. And that's right away that this is confusing to some people. Because in everyday language, when we use the word reduction or reduce, it usually involves losing something, right? Like weight reduction, for instance, or payroll reduction. But in chemistry, reduction is the gain of an electron. That still makes sense, though, linguistically, if you think about what electrons are carrying, which is negative charge, right? So the gain of an electron is going to reduce numerically the charge. If you are receiving an electron, you are becoming more negative, which is a reduction in your numeric charge, either from 0 to negative 1, for instance. Right? So it's going down by receiving it. Well, that is just exactly the opposite of oxidation. Oxidation is the loss of an electron. And these two definitions should explain why you can't have one process without the other. Because electrons aren't just popping into existence or ceasing to exist. Right? They are there the whole time. It's a transfer of an electron in a redox reaction. Therefore, something has to lose it something loses it only if something else gains it. Now, if you have those two in mind, good grasp of those definitions, then let me give you two more that are also a little bit confusing at first. In any given redox reaction, something is becoming reduced and something is becoming oxidized. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a redox reaction. And just keep in mind, the thing that is becoming reduced is gaining an electron. The thing that's becoming oxidized is losing an electron. But the thing that is becoming reduced is called the oxidizing agent. And that makes sense because if you are being reduced yourself by receiving the electron, that means you are causing something else to be oxidized by taking that electron from it. That's why you are called the oxidizing agent by receiving that electron and becoming reduced yourself. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Conversely, the thing that is becoming oxidized is called the reducing agent. Because by becoming oxidized, something is losing an electron. Well, it has to lose that electron to something else. And that something else becomes reduced. So the thing being oxidized is the reducing agent. Now, the reason I bring all that up is because a monosaccharide, or monosaccharides as a category, are called sometimes reducing sugars. Obviously, they're sugars, right? But monosaccharides are called reducing sugars as opposed to more complex sugars. Remember I said that the word sugar is roughly equivalent to carbohydrate. There are simple sugars and there are complex sugars. Disaccharides and above are complex sugars. But monosaccharides are not only sugars, they are reducing sugars, which means they are reducing agents in certain redox reactions. The reducing agent becomes oxidized, right? But it's the reducing agent because something else becomes reduced in that process. So this brings up Benedict's solution, which is the blue stuff in the back there. That's what you use for Benedict's test. Before you add the unknown solution to that, the stuff by itself is called Benedict's solution or Benedict's reagent. And it's mostly water, but it's a solution in which quadrillions of copper ions are dissolved. Now, ions we've discussed in lecture, but I didn't get into to what I'm about to tell you. Keep in mind the duality of elements. These are all the metals, most of them, and the ones that are to the left of the diagonal, right? So most elements are metals. And the ones that we were talking about when we discussed ions were all from groups 1 or 2, like sodium and magnesium and calcium, for instance. Any one of the elements in group 1, remember that hydrogen is a metal, a non-metal, so lithium downward, all of those in that same group can form ions, but only one way. A group 1 element, if it's going to ionize, is always going to ionize by losing exactly one electron to become a positive 1 ion. Right? That's what we've discussed. And group 2 elements are always going to ionize just one way as well, by losing 2 electrons to become positive 2 ions. But in this range, to the right of that, in the middle here, there are the so-called transition metals. And many of those metals can form ions more than one way, unlike group 1 and group 2. And that includes copper. Copper is in there, Cu. Well, copper, if it's going to be an ion, can be either a copper 2 ion, which is one that has lost 2 electrons to become positive 2 charge, or you can have a copper 1 ion. It's just a positive 1 charge. If you have a solution in which every one of the dissolved copper ions is a copper 2 ion, then that's what makes that solution to us look that color of blue back there. So Benedict's solution is only copper 2 ions in solution. All right, now to the solute that actually causes the reaction to occur. In other words, the thing that the test tests for, which is monosaccharides. Now, if you think back to the monosaccharides lectures that I've talked about, remember that there are two forms of any given monosaccharide. There's a linear form and a ringed form, right? What is different about other than the shape, what is different about the ringed form versus the linear form? I didn't hear that.
You have to use the ringed form.
That's the shape, though. What is actually different other than the shape?
It's linear form.
Yes, the linear form has a carbonyl group that's C double bonded to the O, right? Remember when I showed you the slide of the linear one bending to become the ringed one? In order to complete that ring, form that other bond, you have to open up a hole in each of those two atoms. And that involves turning that double bond between C and O into a single bond. So that means the ringed form of a monosaccharide does not have a carbonyl. That's important for this test, because the double bond, if it's there in the carbonyl, is an easy source of an electron that can be transferred in a redox reaction. Another way of saying that is that what makes a monosaccharide a reducing sugar is that it can easily give up an electron from that double bond that it has in the carbonyl group if it's in the linear form. And something that it can easily give that electron up to is a copper 2 ion. The ones that make the solution look blue to us. Right, so one of the four electrons that make up that double bond, remember it's two pairs of shared electrons, four overall electrons, one of those leaves the sugar and gets put onto the copper 2 ion. So what happens to the copper in that case? Well, I mean of the two processes involved in redox. Yes, the copper is becoming reduced by receiving that electron from the sugar. That's why the sugar is the reducing agent. It's reducing something else. Okay? And so, back to the first thing you said, if that happens, then a copper 2 ion, which has currently a positive 2 charge, is going to turn into a copper 1 ion. Notice that is a reduction numerically from positive 2 to positive 1, because it takes that extra electron. The reason that is good for us in terms of the test is that that's a visual change, visible change. Copper 1 ions in solution, if you have nothing but copper 1 ions in solution, then it's not blue at all. It's brick red. But the qualitative aspect of the test is that you get different colors in between those two extremes. Right? You have trillions and trillions of copper 2 ions to start with. Maybe just some of them get reduced, but not all of them. And so it goes from blue to green to yellow, all different colors until finally deep brick red. And therefore you can say not only is there monosaccharide present, but there must be a hell of a lot because this is brick red. Or positive, but not so positive. Okay? So what happens to the sugar in that case? It gets oxidized because it has lost its electron. Now, explain why starch, which works for the IKI test, does not work for the Benedict's test. Starch is nothing but glucose, which is a monosaccharide, right? Why doesn't it have double bonds? Why doesn't it have carbonyl groups? Starch, that is. Or any polysaccharide or any disaccharide, for that matter. What about the glycosidic linkage?
You need to get rid of the double bond so you can...
No, you don't have to get rid of the double bond for the glycosidic linkage, but it's close. In order to make a glycosidic linkage, though, what do you already have to have in place? What did I say in lecture has to be true if you're going to link two monosaccharides together? What has to be true about the monosaccharides? They have to be in what form?
Ringed form.
Ringed form. What did we just say making a ring does? When you turn a linear sugar into a linear monosaccharide into a ringed monosaccharide, what did we just say happens? You lose the carbonyl group, right? Because you can't have that double bond if you're going to complete the ring. Therefore, if you have a disaccharide or bigger, all you have are ringed forms, no carbonyl groups, and therefore no available electrons to reduce copper 2 to copper 1. So yes, it's made out of pure glucose starches, but not glucose in the linear form. And it doesn't have to be glucose in the linear form. Any monosaccharide in the linear form will have a carbonyl. That's why any monosaccharide is a reducing sugar, but any disaccharide, trisaccharide, or polysaccharide is not a reducing sugar. All that clear? That's the basis of the test. So the only other things I want to say are why you go through the procedure. You have three tests to work with, right? And using these visual tests properly means, by properly I mean in situations where you really don't know what's there. You're trying to determine it. You're using an unknown, in other words. To properly do that, you have to first have a good idea of what a true negative looks like and what a true positive looks like. That's why you go through preliminarily, for each of the three tests, at least two tests with known solutions. For each of the three tests, you want to use something that you know does not have the stuff you're testing for. So for Benedict, you would pick something that you know definitely does not have any monosaccharides in it. So you can see a true negative. Something else you pick that definitely has a monosaccharide, so you see a true positive, right? Similarly, you choose things for a true negative and a true positive for the other two test types. That's all the preliminary stuff using known solutions, all of which are on your baskets, your white baskets. Now, for the other two tests besides Benedict's, your testing solution is also in the baskets. For Benedict's test, the Benedict solution is back here. And I just want to make sure you understand how to use these things that are called repipetters. It's really just a pump, but don't try pushing it down like a shampoo pump. Instead, you have to lift them up. But first, have your test tube over the nozzle so you don't spill the stuff. You just grab this whole cylinder. Don't move this blue piece at all. It should be locked in the vertical position already at 2. But you lift up this whole barrel until it stops. And then you just gently push it down until it stops on the bottom, and that will deliver exactly 2 mils for you. Okay, that's all there is to that. But anyway, for each of these three tests, you do a true negative, a true positive. You get a good look at those. And then it tells you to do one other solution. That can be your choice. Doesn't matter. That's all preliminary work, though, so that you can then work with unknown solutions, which are over here on the red. Don't start with these. You have to do your 9 other tests first, 3 for each of the 3. But notice that there's 3 columns, A, B, and C, A1 through A4, and similarly for B and C. Every one of these bottles is different, so the A's are not the same as each other. That's why you choose an A, any of the A's you want, any of the B's and any of the C's, but one of each, and you write down which one you have, 1 through 4, because it matters. And as it says here, shake before you actually use it. Not shake the hell out of it, just shake it a few times to get it well mixed. But those are your unknowns. Not completely unknown, though, because the packet tells you what they could be. Gives you a list of things that they could be. And your task is to use all 3 of these tests to try to narrow down what each of your A, B, and C actually contains. And I don't know, but I can look it up when you're ready to, with your guesses, come up to me and we can see how well you did. The idea here, though, is that you have to run each of the 3, A, B, and C, with all 3 tests. You do a Benedict's for the A you choose, you do a IKI, and you do a biuret for that same solution, A whatever. And then same thing for B and same thing for C. So that's 9 additional tests that you run for your unknowns. Then you logically, based on your results, positives and negatives, and the strengths of those positives, try to narrow it down in as to which one is in which container. That all make sense? That's why, once again, you should be working in groups. You technically could do this alone, but it's a lot easier and quicker if you work in groups and you can talk it out. So move around however you want to form those groups, and let me know if you need help.